trained a lot of police.
And that's what happens, right?
It was okay, but
I know. I was totally surprised and shocked by that.
It's a little warm.
But I am trying to listen.
Good afternoon. We're going to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order.
Oh, wow. You're really sucking up.
So if members, go ahead and work your way to your seats. We've got a very interesting agenda for this afternoon. Thank you all for being here and for participating in all the work that went in to the bills that are going to be, or the topics that are going to be presented here today. As soon as we get committee members' attention here, we'll get the ball rolling. First thing I want to do is to introduce a senator who will be our newest member of the committee. Senator Bobby Jo Champion is going to be, one session starts, will be replacing Senator Cohen, who found that his overwhelming committee commitments were too much to handle. And he served many years on the Judiciary Committee, and his advice and consultation was always welcome, and I'm sure he will not be shy in sharing that with us, even when he's off the committee.
But we've got
a welcome addition here in Senator Champion, who has a long history privately and professionally, I should say professionally, in the field of law. So it's good to have another lawyer on the committee.
Roll call.
Replace one lawyer with another. I think we're still outnumbered, however, even on this committee, which is unusual.
As it should be.
So what we're going to do today is have just an informational hearing. We're not going to take any action on Senate File 1676 or any of the proposals before us today. We will be listening to came before the Joint House and Senate Expungement Working Group, and there's no formal bill yet introduced on that either. The working group is going to be meeting before session. I think February 17th is the next scheduled meeting. To review the details of the proposal. And so we're not going to be taking any public comment on this hearing. That will be saved for the time when we have a formal bill before us. And when we then hopefully we'll take some action on it. I will note there was one request from a constituent to talk about expungement, and my office let him know that there won't be any public testimony and that that will happen at a later time, and we certainly will then open up the floor for public to participate directly on the record in this discussion. Before we get to Mark Haase, who's going to provide us with an overview of the matter, Senator Champion has an NCSL event to get to in Minneapolis, so I'm going to ask him first if he would step forward or have a seat at the table and go over the proposal that the Joint House and Senate Expungement Working Group has been working on. Once you get it through the next expungement meeting, the working group meeting, then we can come back and look at your formal proposals. But please, Senator Champion, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for having me today. And I might say that I'm pretty excited about being on the judiciary. Whenever I can serve under Senator Latz, I'm always looking forward to that opportunity to extract some of that wisdom that he has and, of course, some of the wisdom from the other committee members.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Where are the donuts?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Well, once the session officially starts, I'll be happy to bring donuts because I think that's what
newbies do.
No,
I just need the donuts and everything's happy.
And sprinkles.
On sprinkles.
And sprinkles.
Senator Lemmer, Maple Grove wants sprinkles.
Okay, I got it. Well noted. Today, just to talk a little bit about the Expungement Working Group, we thought it would be important just to talk about where we are and how we've gotten to this particular point and what our next action steps would be. As you probably know, is that over the interim, Representative Hillstrom and I decided it would be crucial to work on a piece of legislation for expungements, and I know that other folks have worked on this as well. To help draft a comprehensive piece of legislation, we decided it would be best to create an expungement working group. The group is comprised of approximately 27 different members from the House and Senate. The co-chairs are myself and Representative Hillstrom. There are 15 Senate members, namely myself, Senator Dibble, Senators Hayden, Franzen, Sharon, Goodwin, Eaton, Desick, Tomasoni, Saxhog, Kiffmeyer, Peterson, Osmek, Benson, and Senator Limmer. There are 12 House members, Hillstrom, Representative Albright, Dean, Draskowski, Holberg, Johnson, Lesch, Liebling, Moline, Mullery, Myra, and Simonson. During the interim, the group has had four meetings to give members a broad view, first of all, of the current state of the expungement world. We had Senate and House counsel do brief overviews of juvenile, adult, and housing expungements. We heard about notions from DHS, the BCA, and other agencies' hiring practices that commonly block past offenders from seeking employment. After this, we opened up the meeting for public testimony, where we heard many stories of those from districts all over Minnesota who had a past offense stop them from finding employment. During this time, many Senate and House offices received calls and emails from the constituents who are constantly haunted by the past. Once we heard from the public, we took expungement proposals for consideration, and at that time, we gave our members an opportunity to put forward proposals. Like, for an example, without going too deep in the woods, Representative Draskowski stated that once and if courts were able to grant expungements, that the court administrator would notify all the agencies that are part of the court's record that the criminal conviction had been expunged, and that they were to send the petitioner a letter indicating which agencies were notified. And after the expungement has been granted, the petitioner is sent confirmation that the information being expunged has been expunged by that agency. And I'm working on a bill that provides that if criminal charges against a person are dismissed, the record is destroyed, and a charged crime results in an acquittal, the file is automatically expunged. That was all a part of his proposal, not necessarily mine. Secondly, Representative Lesch put forth a proposal to give the court authority to seal records held in the executive branch, and he referred to House File 1237 from 2007 and 2008. County attorneys had proposed before House File 2723, which was from Representative Woodard from 2011 and 2012, which provided a brief summary of what they can and can't support. It just talked about a number of different things. Like, for an example, if the county attorneys agree with defense counsel and the court that someone's diversion record or stay of adjudication after they complete that diversion program or stay of adjudication and then 1 year removed from that time, if there are no new offenses, then that record should and could be expunged, especially if there is consent. Representative Liebling also wanted to give the district court authority to order DHS to set aside a conviction for purposes of human services employment, and that was one of the more challenging notions put forward just because of the complexity around the DHS issue. Representative Muddlery, for an example, and lastly, talked about to the group about unlawful detainers, and he had a real sort of extensive notion as to looking at how we should put forth legislation that will streamline the housing expungement or unlawful detainer hearings, providing the housing court judge with the authority at that UD hearing to expunge a record if the matter is resolved in the tenant's favor or if there's agreement, but that's just a part of what he put forward. Although there is like three other components to it, I would spare you the time of really articulating every aspect of it. But the bottom line is that we've looked at a number of different things, heard from the public, been talking to law enforcement and county attorneys and others, trying to put together what we believe will be a consensus bill that we would like to present to not only our committee when it convenes again on February 17th, but hopefully that work will also be put forward in a bill that will come before the legislature and notably to this particular committee. So that's a synopsis of what has been going on. And so, again, as the chair articulated earlier, we have our next meeting February 17th. The committee will get the latest proposal by email, which embodies all these various notions that have been talked about and some agreed upon by, you know, let's say, key stakeholders. And then the committee will have an opportunity on February 17th to look at the proposal, propose any changes, and then the committee will vote on that. And then hopefully that will be the bill that we'll put forward to the legislature. So that is what's going on.
Thank you, Senator Champion. I want to note that your work, you noted some of the legislative history on this issue. I will note that in the room, anyway, there are at least two of us have carried expungement bills in the past. Senator Ortman has worked hard on this issue. We've been dedicated to it, and I have carried expungement legislation as well. I mean, I know there are some of the task force members also are seated at the table here, the working group members. But I want to commend you for all the work that you've put in out of session here to pull all of this together. There's a lot of work involved, a lot of stakeholders that care about this, and kudos to you for the work that you've done in getting it to this point. So are there any questions for Senator Champion from members of the committee? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I've enjoyed what limited time I've had to be a part of that work group. I've noticed, though, that during the interim, your original concepts, I think, were originally focused on criminal charges for expungement. And during the hearings that we have had during the interim, there's been an expanded base of interest to kind of amend other concerns onto your bill. The issue of unlawful detainers, landlord-tenant relations, and what information would go back and forth on tenant reviews and searches, as well as work employer-employee relationships. Being a member, if I could give you any advice, my interest is more in the criminal charges and expungement. I would caution us to go too far beyond the original scope. I think it's a good one. I think your scope is good. And certainly if there's been an individual that has sincerely changed their ways from a criminal past and now wanting to be a productive citizen and has proven over time that they do not ever intend to going back to any type of criminal behavior, that should be recognized in some kind of way. Not to the point of being a full equivalent to a pardon extraordinaire that we have, but something that would encourage an individual and perhaps others that might see that what they did in the past, maybe a stupid mistake in their younger years, will follow them. And will follow them and have drastic consequences for employment and residency in certain apartment houses are certainly important for them to consider. And if they see someone else being successful, they too could change their ways and want the better offerings of what society can give to those who want to really be productive. So that's the only comments I have. I haven't had an opportunity to really have a long time or a number of days on the commission, but nevertheless, it's something that we should continue to work for.
Chair Letts.
Senator Champion.
Senator Limmer, thank you so much for your advice and observation. And to echo what Chair Letts has articulated already is that I know that there's been a number of you that have been working on this issue for quite some time, like Senator Ortman as well. And I think your work prior to this moment has been very fruitful and helpful in getting folks to understand the depth and the gravity of the issue and that something needs to be done. And so kudos to all of you for the work that you've done, and I stand on your shoulders as we continue to push this legislation forward. Specifically to the advice around, you know, how we initially were looking at, you know, criminal records, and there was some other expansive discussion. Like, for an example, there was some real discussion around mugshot.com, for an example. And mugshot.com, for committee members that may not know, is really a site where individuals' mugshots from being arrested is put up on the site. And initially, mugshot.com would require a subject who may have never been charged with anything, in order to get their mugshot removed from that site, they would have to pay them $299. And if they were unable to do that, then that, you know, mugshot stays there. But now it has become a little more sophisticated around this issue, saying, hey, we get so much traffic now, or they get so much traffic on that site that they don't ask the subject of, or the person whose picture there to pay them $299 now, but they get sponsors now who says, hey, because we can put our logo up there and there's the traffic that is driven to that particular site, then it's attractive for us. So that was an issue that was constantly coming before the committee. And what we did initially and have decided to do is that that's a separate issue from expungement, right? Because that is really like, how do you deal with regulation around the release of those pictures or mugshots? How do you balance that with, you know, the right of the media to get information or businesses to get information? And that's separate and apart from the work that we are putting forward. But what was beneficial about the discussion is that it gave us an opportunity to become aware of all these other ancillary issues that could potentially impact a person's journey to find gainful employment or just to deal with that issue. So I really do recognize that. And so when we think in terms of expungements, though, there's this notion of criminal records, juvenile records, and then also housing. Not necessarily diving too deep into the landlord-tenant issue, but how can we streamline this notion of expungements even around housing? Because there was some testimony, and I would put forward that an individual, for an example, could be a renter, and I'm not saying this happens in every situation, but would ask the landlord to make a repair. The landlord decides not to for whatever reason. The tenant decides that he or she is going to put their rent in escrow. Money's in escrow. The landlord says, hey, give me the money, the rent, and the person says, no, I need you to make these repairs. And let's say the landlord doesn't. And so the landlord says, I'm going to file an unlawful detainer based on the fact that you have not paid me this month's rent. Unlawful detainer is filed. Tenant goes to court and prevails. But the problem is that judge at that particular time cannot seal that record. Now that tenant who prevailed at that hearing would have to file a separate petition and pay a separate filing fee and do all that other good stuff, right? So I think there is the possibility that we will propose that should be streamlined and just say, hey, if at that particular hearing that there is the possibility for that record to be sealed or removed, then fine. Because guess what happens? Even if a tenant prevails, that unlawful detainer record stays there until it's sealed somehow, even if you prevail. So those are the concerns that have risen to the top, and we'll continue to streamline it so that we are not convoluting the system or making it so controversial or complex that people, you know, shy away from it. So we want to make sure that there's a real good balance between access and opportunity while people's lives are improved and all folks are considered, even law enforcement and others, as they look at these records or have access to these records.
So we'll have an opportunity once there's a formal bill before us to dive into the details of the proposals at that point. Are there any further general questions for Senator Champion, or should we let him go to his NCSL panel?
I encourage you to keep working on this issue. It's so important, and I think there is a huge consensus that we can change the outcome here and people can earn that second chance. But I hope that when you come back and we talk more about the language, how we address the fundamental problem that the judges can't grant expungements that will then be enforced by the executive branch. I mean, I think that's a huge obstacle to what we're trying to accomplish here, and I wonder if there's any way around it, over it, through it, or to take down that obstacle. And I wonder if your group, your working group, has considered that. I want to make sure that what we do is meaningful. You know, and we tend to legislate around the edges to big problems like this, and I'm hoping that this is the year that we can actually address the fundamental problem that when folks have a criminal record, it's hard for them to find a job, to find an apartment, and to gain that opportunity for a fresh start, even though they may have earned it. And I think judicial orders would be good, and I wonder if we shouldn't be putting together a structure for our judges for a broader authority. And so I know that's a lot to think about, but I hope in our next conversation, Mr. Chair and Senator, that we'll talk about that.
And to that, just briefly, that is something that the committee is wrestling with as well, is how do we make sure that we have a substantive, meaningful, and balanced balanced approach to this issue. And so from my vantage point, I think that would make sense. We don't want judges just to make a decision and then it doesn't go anywhere. How can we give them the tools that will eventually benefit all parties, right? So that the person can have an opportunity at a second chance, and how can we balance that with access, and how can we balance that with making sure that there's the appropriate safeguards in place in order to make sure that these records are kept in a way that's meaningful. So with that being said, I know that the committee has to go forward, but I can talk a lot about this issue because I am a lawyer. I would like for you to know.
Senator Champion, thank you. All right, we're going to welcome Mark Hazy to the table now. Mark is Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice, and you'll give us a presentation, an overview of records expungement.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senators. Thank you very much for having me here to discuss this important topic. Just briefly, the Council on Crime and Justice is a nonprofit based in Minneapolis that provides direct services for both people who have offended and those who have been victims of crime. We conduct criminal justice research, and we engage in public policy advocacy. And on the expungement issue, we have been closely involved with this, put a lot of resources into this over many years, from providing clinics and other services for people with criminal records, advising employers on how to handle these records, to amicus briefs at the courts of appeals, taking a case all the way to the Supreme Court, and then, of course, being here at the legislature advocating on this issue over the years. And we do advocate for some expansion of expungement remedies, full disclosure. We do it in a way that we think will increase public safety by providing second chances so people can move on and be productive, as well as taking into consideration all the many things that have to be considered on this issue. So my task here is to give you an overview of the law. This law and this topic can be very complicated, confusing, and misunderstood. And it would be really easy to spend several hours on this. I'm going to do my best to distill it down to what you really need to know. So with that, before I jump into the law, though, I'm going to really take a step back and give some broad brush strokes on issues that you've heard about over the years in this committee, but just a reminder of why we're at where we're at today on this issue. We've heard about, the problem that we have here is when somebody has a criminal record, they may be held back from employment, housing, higher education, licenses, numerous things. One of the trends that's happened in recent past is the increased number of people, percentage of our population, that has some kind of a record. According to the Pew Research Center, 1 in 26 Minnesotans is currently under some form of correctional control. And we have the 8th highest rate of correctional control in the country. Estimates are that one in four Americans has some kind of a criminal record now. Now, that could include arrest records, and we'll talk about those today, but those can also be a barrier. The trend in Minnesota here, this is a graph of felony offenses per year. So in 1981, there were about 5,000 felony convictions. In 2008, there were about 15,000. If you look at the top, since 1982, there's been a 380% increase in the rate of Minnesotans under correctional control. So back in 1982, 1 in 98 Minnesotans was currently serving some kind of a sentence, and now, as you saw on the previous slide, it's 1 in 26. Another thing that's changed greatly is access. It used to be that you had to go to the courthouse or a police station to get a paper record. Like many things, the internet age has changed the whole landscape of criminal records and how we deal with them. And what we're doing here today is just, like in many areas, trying to catch up with that. Now you can get somebody's record on mugshots.com from your laptop, or there are many other points of access. The use of these records has also greatly increased. This is a survey from the Society on Human Resources Management. The green is the percentage of employers, 73%, that conduct a background check for all candidates. Add the 19% for certain job candidates, and 93% of employers now conduct a background check. And I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but about 15 years ago, that was more in the 40 to 50% range. So we've got increased use by private entities. At the same time, the legislature, Congress, has been adding to the list of things that are in law that are called collateral sanctions. Now, that's as you get into the later in the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act, it's important to distinguish sanctions from consequences. A collateral consequences could be the stigma of an employer. It's all the things that could be a consequence of a criminal record. A sanction is something that the government imposes. Currently, there are over 500 collateral sanctions in Minnesota law. Those are all summarized in Chapter 609B. Each one has about a 1 to 2 sentence summary, and I think when I looked at the PDF version of that, it was about 38 pages long, referencing everywhere else in the statutes where there are collateral sanctions. And like every session, I'm sure you'll see. I assume you'll see efforts to add to this session. An important note here too is the different impact of these issues by race. We know that the criminal justice system itself has a disparate impact upon people of color. But when you look at the back end of that, the impact of the record, this is research that was conducted by a sociologist named Diva Pager in Milwaukee several years ago. She had testers go out and apply for jobs, and she had them, the testers have similar type of dress, exact same resume, background, apply for the same job. The difference was some were white and some were black. And the ones I highlighted here, a white man with a criminal record received a callback 17% of the time. A black man with a criminal record received a callback 5% of the time. So add that to the disparities that exist that create the records, and this leads to a large segment of the community being cut out from opportunity. And just a note at the bottom, some of the printing here is small. I apologize for that. This was for a felony cocaine with intent to distribute conviction from, I want to say it was 7 to 10 years in the past. And drug offenses are, we know that the disparities are high there. So the primary records at issue that we're talking about here, before we get into law, it's really important to keep these straight. There's the court records. That's referred to as MNSIS now. That's the court's statewide electronic access database. That has also, it's publicly accessible. There are some different levels of accessibility at the courthouse versus remotely. That was recently made statewide. So that's added some different dynamics from when it was county by county. Another primary record is the local law enforcement records that can be accessed. Those are the ones that end up on mugshots.com. And note that that's an executive branch record. Those have indefinite retention periods like the court, and they're also publicly accessible. And then the BCA, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension records, which is where records are collected. They're forwarded by the courts and law enforcement. That's an executive branch location. And there again, it's indefinite retention. Most of those records are public for 15 years, felony convictions and some other identified convictions, and the rest are private. And the felony convictions become private after 15 years, but it's important to note that that private designation in the Data Practices Act just means that you can't get it, you know, on the internet if you don't have the person's access, but with the informed consent of the subject, then that record can be accessed. So when somebody signs a consent to have that record done, checked for employment or housing, that private record can be accessed as well. So those are the records we're talking about. What about private databases? You're going to hear, at some point in the debate, and you've heard it before, that what's the use of expungement if it's already out there with these private data harvesters? These are the commercial databases used for employment and housing. But it's important to note that there are some laws that regulate the use of those under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that federal law requires that those records be updated. My second point here, something that you all may want to consider, is would Minnesota want to further limit how those agencies disseminate and employers use those expunged records? That would help with that issue of it's just out there anyways. Now, yes, with our electronic age, once somebody has a criminal record, it is hard to put it back. But under various laws, it should, if it's properly handled by the consumer reporting agencies, and maybe there's some other strengthening of that, it shouldn't be used for purposes of employment and housing. Now, the Ban the Box legislation that you passed this last session should help rather than have that background check done immediately and the application being thrown in the garbage. Now when an employer has selected somebody for an interview, they can do a background check, and there may be more of a conversation that can occur about whether that record was expunged or not and whether it comes up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orman.
Thank you. Mr. Hazy, I really appreciate all your work on these issues. On that particular question, I was not a big fan of Ban the Box, not because I didn't want people to have a chance to have their applications considered, but the bigger issue for me was I had a client that wanted an expungement, and I couldn't help that client because I knew what was going to happen. If you get a judicial expungement, it doesn't make any difference. And so one of the thoughts that I had, and I think we put it in previous legislation, was to authorize people who had earned an expungement to deny the criminal record. To say it would be lawful for this applicant to deny a felony conviction or a misdemeanor conviction if they had also earned an expungement, and then offer the employer immunity and from having to find out that this person was a felon and not allowing them to use that record in the employment decision. Is that a discussion that's been had in the working group as a proposal here?
Mr. Hazy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, thank you. There's been discussed, and one of the last proposals I saw had a provision that would limit the third-party data collector's dissemination of expunged records. The issue of somebody not having to disclose the record, I'll touch on that later. There's a provision in current law for that for drug offenses. And I wouldn't be opposed to that. I think that the challenge with that is if the person applying for the opportunity denies it, it says that in law, but the employer is asking for it or getting it, they may not know that the individual has been authorized by law to not disclose it. So it's a good, really good question, and I think it's something that has to be looked at really closely in this, because something that could, there may be some employer resistance to this also, but maybe not, would be to add the Ban the Box that, the employer could put a notice on their application materials that the person need not to disclose an expunged record. You may or may not like that, but I think it's a really good thing that has to be closely looked at as we have this discussion.
Mr. Chair, I think if the expungement order and the statute actually said that the applicant had the right to deny the criminal conduct, so that when the job applicant said you have a criminal history, there's a no, they would have the court order that authorized that. The immunity paired with that would authorize would take the risk away from the employer in hiring somebody who had denied having a criminal record, and there would have been an order backing it up. I think that might be one of the ways to go here, and I hope that you will at least put it on the list of things to consider and discuss with this working group as you go forward.
Mr. Hawsey.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, yes, thank you, and I'll discuss that with Senator Champion, or of course you could, and we'll try to make sure we're covering that area really well. Good suggestion. On your employer liability note, this comes up often. What about employer liability? Well, Senator Latz was the chief author of this bill in 2009 that we sometimes call the Safe Hiring Bill. And what this does a number of things to protect employers from liability, but the point two that I highlighted here is that an employee's criminal history cannot be introduced as evidence if the offense had been expunged or pardoned. Now, in this, to your point, Senator Ortman, in the legislation, it may be good to reference this or to make sure that a judge is putting this in the order, you know, some way that one of the issues we've had with this is it's really good law, but, you know, a lot of we've been trying to educate employers about it, but a lot of employers still don't know about it. And we did add to the Ban the Box legislation this last session that if they don't ask at the initial stage, if they follow Ban the Box, then they wouldn't be found liable as well. Based on that. So, current law. Some basics that generally apply to all expungement. This is, as I mentioned, the court-ordered sealing of government-held records. It's not the destruction of a record. Expungement literally means destruction, but in Minnesota law, the record's not destroyed. It requires the filing of a petition and a filing fee, in most cases, in the county of the record for each record. Requires notice to all record-keeping agencies where the sealing is sought. It requires appearance at a court hearing, and the burden of proof and standard varies by type of expungement. And I'll cover all this. But these are just some things to keep in mind, you know, for the law and also for how people access the remedy. So there are four main types of criminal expungement. And I put it in quotation marks because I'm including juvenile delinquency here. A juvenile offense is not by definition a crime, and that's why in my general materials I said juvenile and criminal expungement. So the first is what we sometimes call 299C11 expungement or remedy, and that applies only to law enforcement records of arrest. And I'm going to go into more detail on each of these. What we call a statutory expungement is pretty much what this the working group, I think, will be focusing on. And that would allow, the key point with that is a statutory expungement, because the legislature has created it, allows the judge to seal executive branch records. An inherent authority expungement seals court records absent appropriate circumstances. Executive branch records could be sealed, but now under current law, which I'll talk about later, it really just applies to court records. And then there's the juvenile delinquency records, which is a separate statute. And based on current case law, that is a complicated issue, but one that I hope is addressed this coming session. So the 299C11 arrest record statute, this applies to arrests where there is no charge or a charge with a dismissal prior to a formal pleading of a finding of probable cause. There are some qualifications for that. There can't have been a felony or gross misdemeanor conviction within the 10 years prior. In those cases, the individual can send a letter to the BCA and to the law enforcement agency and have those records returned. It's a pretty good remedy. If you've been arrested, you don't have these prior arrests, and you know about it, and you are able to write a letter and find the right place to do it. Otherwise, the record just stays out there, even if the charges were dismissed or only arrested. A statutory expungement, Minnesota Statute 609A. Again, the important thing to note about this is that it allows the judge to seal not just court records, but executive branch records. And the crimes that are the cases that are allowable under this statute are certain generally low-level, usually first-time controlled substance offenses, juveniles prosecuted as adults, and certain criminal procedures defined as resolved in favor of the petitioner. I'll touch on that in a moment. One thing to note is the statute does prohibit expungement of cases where predatory offense registration is required. The category of not resolved in favor, basically what the courts have, how the courts have defined this is if somebody has admitted to the facts or made an admission on the record, then that is not resolved in favor. So in some counties, that includes diversion programs, an Alford plea, or a stay of adjudication where somebody has been told if you admit to the facts, you will, and you complete your probation, you won't have a conviction on your record. Well, the stay of adjudication is still on their record, and it appears. And not only that, but they cannot have the record sealed at the executive branch under current law.
Mr. Hawsey?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would that also include situations where there's an agreement to suspend prosecution, but there was an admission of facts as a part of that agreement?
Mr. Chair, if it was done on the record, I think the court would interpret it as not resolved in favor. If it's done prior to it being recorded by the court, I believe that's resolved in favor.
As often there's a form. It says an agreement to suspend prosecution. It's got the terms, and at the bottom it says defendant admits to certain facts as well. And I don't think that content is entered into the electronic records of the court, but the form is part of the official court file.
Mr. Chair, I'm not 100% on that. Someone else might be able to answer that more accurately than me. I believe if it's my understanding of those, and I don't practice criminal law, but it's a tool for the prosecutor to have that if they need it, and it's not formally entered into the records, the court records.
Thank you.
One thing to note about here, this getting this stay of adjudication included in the statute so that executive branch records and all diversions is something that has been – that's the legislation that I've worked with and others have worked with the county attorneys on past sessions that we've gotten pretty far through the process but not passed. What's the burden of proof and the standard for a statutory expungement? Now, if it's if the case is one of those resolved in favor cases, then the burden is on the state – to essentially show the person is not in need or deserving of the expungement. But in all other cases where there's a conviction, the drug cases, the juvenile adult certification, it's an extraordinary remedy to be granted only upon clear and convincing evidence that it would yield a benefit to the petitioner commensurate with the disadvantages to the public and the public safety of sealing the record and burdening the court and public authorities to ensure issue, enforce, and monitor an expungement order. This is important to keep in mind as things that may be added to the expungement statute. What is the burden? Because if the legislature adds things to the statute that either limits or expands the court's authority, it can also control what that burden is. In other words, if the legislature allows the court to seal more executive branch records, it doesn't mean that it's on automatic expungement or it's going to happen. There can still be this burden that has to be met. After that waiting period, if there were to be a waiting period. So I mentioned earlier the records are not destroyed. What is the access and who can access it? This is in the same statute, 609A. So these records, after they're expunged even, may be opened for purposes of a criminal investigation, prosecution, or sentencing upon an ex parte court order. For the non-lawyers in the group, ex parte means without the other party present, so law enforcement prosecution can go directly to a judge, make a case, and the judge would open the record. Another thing of note is upon request by law enforcement, prosecution, or corrections authorities, an agency or jurisdiction subject to the expungement order shall inform the requester of the existence of a sealed record and of the right to obtain access to it as provided by this paragraph. So in other words, if somebody's had a record expunged in another county, and they get accused of a crime in a different county, the prosecutor wants to do a background check, which my understanding is they do it as a matter of course. They send that background check to the BCA. Under this statute, the BCA is required to tell them that an expunged record exists. Under current law, if they want to have that open, they have to get an ex parte court order. But it's not like they wouldn't have any knowledge of its existence under current law. Point of access is it may be opened for purposes of a background study under Section 245C, that's the Department of Human Services Background Study Act, unless the court order for expungement is directed specifically to the Commissioner of Human Services. Those are the primary access points. So now I'm switching from statutory expungements to the inherent authority of the court expungement. This is not something that the legislature really has control over. This is what the court can do based on these records being their own records. But the issue here is what has really led – it's what led to the the formation of the working group that Senator Champion talked about. This is a way for the court to expunge anything that doesn't fit under the expungement statute or court records only. It's created by the courts. It's a creature of case law. And the scope of relief has expanded and contracted over the last few years. A number of years ago, courts were sealing executive branch records under their inherent authority quite frequently. And then in 2005, there was a state court of appeals case called State v. Schultz, where the issue of separation of powers came up. And in that case, the court said the district court should be very, very careful when it goes to sealing the records of another branch of government, the executive branch. So the issue is, in what circumstances may a district court judge seal the criminal records maintained outside of the judicial branch? And again, in summary, the courts of appeal have provided very varying answers in the recent years. The cases have gone back and forth on this issue. Until May of this year in the Minnesota Supreme Court case of State v. MDT, and it was this case that I think was a primary factor in the working group for me. Just quickly, I thought it would be nice for you to have the facts of at least one of these cases that people bring forth. MDT is the person, the woman who was charged here. In 2006, she was charged with felony-level forgery. She altered a Robitussin with codeine prescription from 200 milliliters to 400 milliliters. She admitted she had done it. She said she did it because she didn't have enough money to afford another prescription and thought this would be one way to do it, not have to go back. Dumb, bad, and illegal mistake. She had no other criminal record. The court stayed the imposition of her sentence, which means they didn't impose a felony sentence, and they gave her probation for 3 years. But she did end up with a misdemeanor conviction. She was discharged early from probation in 2008. She remained crime-free. She had a good work history of denials due to the record. In 2011, the district court granted the expungement of the court records and the executive branch records. That was appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and they affirmed the district court's use of their discretion to seal not only court records but executive branch records. And then the Supreme Court decision reversed that sealing. They found that the district court abused its discretion by sealing executive branch records. They found there was no constitutional rights violation and that it was not necessary to the performance of a core judicial function. They said a court's authority to expunge its own record does not empower it to expunge executive branch records, even if it's generated in the judicial branch. And they found that the order contravened the statute's limited, enumerated list of offense types for expungement. So that last point really brings us to the legislature. If some of these records are going to be sealed at the executive branch, what the court is saying is you all have to authorize it. So the summary is for executive branch records, for some diversions, all stages of adjudication, and all convictions except for the few drug convictions listed under 609A, the Minnesota Supreme Court is not allowing district courts to seal executive branch records. The final type of expungement is juvenile records expungement. As I mentioned earlier, there's a separate statute on that. It's 260B.198 in the Juvenile Code. And that basically states that the court may expunge an adjudication of delinquency at any time that it deems advisable. So under this statute, many judges in the past have been sealing not only court records, but executive branch records for juveniles. To our knowledge, there had not been any appeals of that. There had not been any court of appeals cases until a case called in regards to the welfare of JJP. And this is the Minnesota Supreme Court case. This also came out in May of this year or last year. And what they said that the expungement of juvenile records under the juvenile statute does not violate the separation of powers. So in other words, because of the statute, a judge can seal the executive branch records. But the court found that the term adjudication of delinquency is limited to the order adjudicating the juvenile delinquent very narrowly. What this means is that additional documents in the executive branch file, such as arrest data, investigation records, and the petition of delinquency, do not fall within that term and would remain. And it's very unclear how those may or may not be used. The Department of Human Services could use those to disqualify somebody. Potentially, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension could give those to people who request it for various purposes. the courts may or may not seal the public if there's a public juvenile record, which there is for 16 and 17 year olds charged with a felony. Actually, the courts could still seal that record under their own authority. Outside of expungement is the issue of pardons, pardon extraordinary, it's called. This is another remedy that people have that I thought would be worth mentioning. The pardon board is made up of the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice. Somebody can petition for a pardon if they have been crime-free for 5 to 10 years, depending on the level of severity of the offense after their discharge of sentence. The benefit is it sets aside and nullifies the conviction, eliminates collateral sanctions based on the convictions. It seals the public BCA records and adds a pardon note to the file, but it does not seal the record. I've represented somebody who had a pardon and that was still showing up and causing problems for them, so then we had to go back and get the record sealed based on the fact that it was pardoned. And the judge in that case sealed not only the court record but the executive branch record, because the separation of powers they found was not applicable because all three branches of government had been represented on the pardon board. But current law does not allow an automatic sealing for that pardoned record. And they are rarely granted. I don't have the numbers for that, but they are pretty uncommon. The process for applying for a pardon is actually fairly simple, but I think I know that not a lot of people try to avail themselves of it, partly because it won't be sealed, partly because the difficulty of obtaining it.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hasse, I noticed on your last line there you term that not sealing the entire record is a drawback. If it was not sealed, who would have access to that record? Would it be prosecutors? Would it be a court? Would it be a judge for sentencing? Who would have access if it is not entirely sealed?
Mr. Hasse.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the court record would still be available publicly. And as noted here, the BCA record would not be publicly accessible, but my understanding is it would be made private, and so somebody with informed consent could still get that. It would note that it had been pardoned. And I don't want to discount, I think, for someone to be able to go to an employer, landlord, and say, yeah, I have this pass and I've been pardoned for it, that I think means a lot to those individuals. But, if they're, especially the court, to my knowledge, the court record wouldn't note a pardon, and so somebody could access that and then assume that the person, if they didn't disclose it, assume they were lying about it or disqualify them based on the record.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
If it was not entirely sealed, let's say this individual did in the future commit a crime, found guilty. Could a court look back for previous criminal activity and find that unsealed record?
Mr. Hasse.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question. Could you please repeat it?
In the case that someone received a pardon extraordinary and then subsequently committed a crime, was found guilty, and upon sentencing, could a judge, in order to look back on a criminal history, could a judge, before he sentenced that individual, could he find that unsealed record?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe he could, yes.
And so maybe in that case it might be a benefit, not necessarily a drawback, if a person resorted back to a life of crime.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I think that's a good point. As you all consider expungement law, an important distinction that needs to be made is, can the public access this, and what's the appropriate access or non-access for the public, and what's the appropriate access for individuals, for government entities like prosecutors, law enforcement, the courts. And we're of the opinion that, somebody is back in the criminal justice system, that those things may become relevant and may be appropriate, and some of that access may be something that can be balanced with the public's lack of access.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Hasse, you made reference in an answer a few minutes ago about how a person could claim that they were pardoned if they were seeking, I can't remember the example, a job or maybe a residency in an apartment or something. But my question is could, once a person receives a pardon extraordinary, could the individual, the subject of that, simply say they have no criminal record? Would that be legally or technically correct? Do they have to admit that they've even been pardoned then?
Mr. Hauser.
I just want to know how it works.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Lermer, I would have to look back, I would have to refer back to the statute on that. I don't know if Senate counsel could do that, or I don't recall. I'm getting this confused with the provision in the expungement statute that I mentioned earlier, that for those drug offenses, it says the person could deny the existence of the record and not be guilty of perjury. I know for pardons, it nullifies the conviction, the language I have here. I can't remember the exact language there.
Senator Limmer, we'll see if we can find an answer for you.
All right.
Circle back at a later time.
Thanks.
Mr. Hauser, go ahead.
So I did take the liberty of making a few policy suggestions here for you all, just some things very broad for your consideration. I think it helps to put some of these possibilities after reviewing the law. One would be to add some convictions to 609A, the expungement statute, and that would allow sealing of executive branch records, probably using the current burden and standard. The question there is going to be, is it best to just give the judges the discretion based on a standard of all records, or are there going to be some records that the policy decision would be to either not allow those to be sealed or to allow them to be sealed after a certain period of time? I think that's going to be the main issue that's going to be debated as this moves forward, is which records and after what time perhaps would be eligible for that expungement. The proposal that Senator Champion mentioned that Representative Lesch put forward would just give the judges their discretion, give that discretion to the judge based on a balancing test and a burden to determine if the individual was eligible for the expungement. The nice thing about that is it can be done on a case-by-case basis, looking at all the circumstances. It doesn't give, and I guess one other thing I would mention that I did earlier is if there were to be time limits, note that just because there's a time limit doesn't mean that it would be automatic after that. You could still require a burden and a balancing test. I already mentioned limiting consumer reporting agency dissemination of records and employers maybe having to handle those records differently. Providing for an administrative expedited sealing in some cases to save court time and make it more available to those without an attorney. Under current law, if you get charged, if your case goes all the way to the charging process and then it's dismissed, you have to go back, you have to file that petition, you have to serve all the different agencies yourself, you have to appear at a hearing. That process through a private attorney could cost $1,500 to $3,000. That's if you were charged and then it was completely dismissed. We believe there's room to have that and maybe more records processed in a way where the court, upon their own accord, could issue an order based on the circumstances of the case that would be delineated and make that an expedited process. Juvenile arrest and delinquency records, we would suggest that the judge should be given discretion to seal those records. Juveniles are a different class. There's a reason we have a separate juvenile system, and the case-by-case determination really needs to be done in those cases, and the judge is the best one to do that. And then if there are individuals that will not have a remedy under expungement, they could never have that record sealed, some other type of a remedy, such as a certificate of rehabilitation or the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act, which Mr. Tennyson is going to speak about here soon, that might be a remedy for those who can't avail themselves of an expungement. And there's a provision in the UCCCA that is essentially a certificate of rehabilitation, and I'll let Mr. Tennyson speak to that. Just a quick note here. One of the services the Council on Crime and Justice provides is a criminal records information line. If you have constituents, friends, Others who wonder why their record appears one way, are they eligible for an expungement? Employers who don't know how to handle a record, we have a criminal records information line for that. We also provide seminars the first Tuesday of each month and the third Saturday of each month. And all that information is available on our website, which is crimeandjustice.org. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you. I hope I was able to cover all this in a way that makes sense.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Hazy at this time? All right, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hazy. We'll proceed to Mr. Tennyson. Tennyson's going to present Senate File 1676. This was introduced last session. Appearing with Mr. Tennyson is they're both former senators, Jack Davies, former Court of Appeals judge as well. Mr. Davies is one of my predecessors in this chairmanship as well. Gentlemen, I'll just remind people we're not taking any action on this bill today, but we're going to hear an overview of it. So go ahead, as you wish.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm accompanied by Jack Davies. We're both commissioners of the National Conference of Uniform Law Commissioners. Can you hear me?
Yeah, pull it forward, if you will.
Okay.
Is that good, then?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. First, I'd like to acknowledge this bill has a wide bipartisan authorship. We have in the House and Senate, and I'll mention their names, but I'd also like to recognize Representative Jerry Hertas, who's here. He's going to become a co-author of the House bill as well. And you have an article that he wrote that I ran across last fall, which is an excellent piece in laying out the issues that he's faced and that he sees. And when I read that, it sounded like he had read the act and was supporting the act. So. Anyway, I'd like to thank you. But in addition, Senator Latz is the chief author, Senator Champion, Senator Senjum, Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator Dietzick. In the House, we have also broad authorship, Senators Representative Lesch, Cornish, Hortman, Draskowski, Paymar, Scott, and then I mentioned Representative Hertas is going to join us, as was Representative Dean. So we have a wide authorship.
Senator Limmer.
Pardon me, Senator Tennyson. Do we have a ruling or anything that prohibits us from making mention of state representatives in the Senate?
That's only what's going on in the House. There's nothing going on.
I recall something to that effect.
Treat that as a rhetorical question, Senator.
I'd like to start out by recognizing we've been talking to the agencies involved in this. I had a great meeting with Jerry Kerber from DHS. We met with the Department of Corrections. We met with the Supreme Court Administrators. We met with various criminal defense groups and so on. We've had some conversation with the County Attorneys Association. But to put this in context, I think the best piece I've seen is what my old friend Bob Johnson, former county attorney in Anoka County, wrote a while back. And he talks about hidden punishment. And I'm going to read this, and Bob has given me permission to do this and use it for this committee. And I think it's a good perspective on why this problem exists and what the dimensions of it are. He says, few people, even among those who work in criminal justice, know of and understand the full consequences of criminal conviction. Aside from punishment imposed by a judge at sentencing, hundreds of other penalties are imposed by rules and laws that do not take into account the nature of the offense or the offender. When a person is convicted of a crime, these barriers will automatically bar the person from employment, take away rights, and may even restrict their movements. The American Bar Association study found 570 such rules in Minnesota. These collateral consequences, denying employment, prohibiting certain activities, make a lot of sense if applied in a common sense manner to a particular offender for a particular crime. We all would agree that a person convicted of a sexual offense with a child should not be allowed to work in a daycare. But that is not how they are applied. They apply without consideration of the nature of the crime or of the characteristics of the offender. Let's understand that each crime may be unique. Stealing a bike from an unattached garage while the owner is busy making dinner is burglary in the first degree.
Breaking into a home at night, stealing electronics and jewelry, and assaulting the owner is also burglary in the first degree, even though the conduct in these scenarios is much more serious. Each offender is different. Age, education, criminal background, circumstances leading to the crime, such as alcohol or drug abuse, peer pressure, economic and family circumstances, are all different for each person convicted. An 18-year-old influenced by alcohol and friends who continues, who commits a crime, is different from a 30-year-old who is committing crimes repeatedly for a profit. They should receive different sentences and different collateral consequences. In sentencing a person for a crime, a judge may take into account the circumstances of the crime and the characteristics of the offender. A judge will want to punish the offender, but not destroy or permanently debilitate him. To this end, the court receives information necessary for an appropriate sentence, including information regarding the offender's background, chemical dependency, and amenability to probation. The judge may not, however, do anything about collateral consequences applied automatically as a matter of law. Beyond the unfair application of blind and blanket applications of these rules and laws, the barriers that they create to participation in society decreases public safety. Probation and parole officers working with offenders to assist them in finding employment, housing, and in law-abiding life know the difficulties their clients face in overcoming these barriers. Unknowingly, we have created a growing underclass that will increasingly threaten our economy and our social stability, to say nothing of the personal hopelessness for those who may have made a minor mistake. If we create unreasonable barriers for an offender to find employment and housing, we create a danger to public safety. You do not need an employment license to burglarize the house or sell drugs. If offenders are unable to find employment and with some justification believe that they are being unfairly prevented from obtaining a job, it seems a small step to survive through criminal activity. The legislature has an opportunity to help fix this problem by adopting the uniform law collateral consequences. That's what former county attorney Robert Johnson said. Let me add some remarks of my own here. Between 1973 and 2009, the prison population in the United States increased by 705%. According to a 2008 Pew study on the states, 1 in 100 at some time are incarcerated. Many more than that, though, are under the supervision of the criminal justice system. According to Pew, 1 in 31 American adults were incarcerated or on parole or on probation. Another Pew study, in Minnesota, approximately 9,500 adults are in prison, and almost all of them will be released at some time. There are many reasons, some of them economic, for trying to make the post-release transition into the community successful and productive. According to Pew, in 2008, the average cost of a day of incarceration was about $78, more than 20 times the cost of probation. Another Pew study found that between 2004 and 2007, Minnesota had the highest recidivism rate of any state, of all the states, with 61% of persons returned to custody within 3 years. I wanted to caution you, though, that those numbers are a little bit difficult to deal with or understand, because it depends on what basis you're starting from. And for example, in North Carolina, they may imprison people for offenses we would not. And you wouldn't expect them to recidivate, so you're dealing with a different population, hard to compare those. But nonetheless, recidivism is a problem. It includes two broad categories: convictions for a new offense and technical violations of parole or probation. Almost all states have underway some way of improving their correction policy and practices. Many of those initiatives involve coordinating offender services with other governmental agencies such as health and housing, community and faith-based organizations. Indeed, the ability to obtain employment, housing, education, and other benefits upon release from incarceration directly affects a person's successful reentry, thereby reducing the chances that they reoffend. Minnesota has over 570 restrictions that affect a person's reentry and ability to obtain housing, employment, licenses, and that sort. The Uniform Law Conference spent 3 years drafting the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act, which is designed to alleviate some of the automatic sanctions and disabilities built into Minnesota law, which are applied regardless of circumstances, with little opportunity for relief, or in the words of Minnesota statutes, set-asides. Specifically, by removing automatic barriers to certain specific benefits such as housing, education, licensing, permits, or jobs, the Uniform Act aims to facilitate more successful reentry. Ultimately, one of the long-term benefits of the Act is to reduce recidivism, making communities safer, and minimizing the criminal justice negative impact on children, families, and reducing the state expenses. Before going into the Act, some detail, it'd be useful to understand some of the common terminology in the Act. Collateral sanctions are penalties, disabilities, or disadvantages that are automatically applied by law. Disqualifications are penalties, disabilities, or disadvantages that are permissive or discretionary. So the term collateral consequences includes both collateral sanctions and disqualifications for understanding the Act. There are many parts of the Act, but I'll break it into two main categories for you. The first addresses notice, and the second addresses relief. Under the first category of notice, the Act promotes fairness by requiring defendants to be notified about collateral consequences at three important points in their case. At or before formal notification of charges so that the defendant can make an informed decision on how to proceed. Second, at sentencing so that a person who wants to prepare for a job upon release does not pursue a course of training or that leads to a dead end where they can't get a license or employment. And third, upon leaving custody so that the person can conform their behavior to the law. The Act also provides clarity in removing ambiguity surrounding and streamlining access to collateral sanctions by creating a centralized list of them. It's an important thing. You have Chapter 609B. That would be replaced with an electronic list, which would be more accurate and also would include all of the sanctions. And also a reference to the federal list of collateral sanctions as well. The reviser has already done a lot of this work and prepared to move forward. Additionally, the Act ensures competent representation as required by the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court of Padilla versus Kentucky. That ruling found lack of competent counsel when a person was deported or subject to deportation and were not informed by their counsel that they were subject to that if they pleaded guilty. The second part of the Act's relief segments includes two avenues for relief from collateral sanctions. First, the Act provides for discretionary relief by allowing the court or the Department of Corrections to issue an order of limited relief. These orders remove a collateral sanctions automatic bar, essentially converting it to a discretionary qualification with two exceptions, which are found in Section 12. A licensing agency, a public housing authority, or the like would then be free to consider whether or not to disqualify a particular person on the merits. That's the decision maker mentioned in the bill. Second, the Act provides for a certificate of restoration of rights, which can be granted, provided the individual has met the requirements in the statute. For example, the granting of the petition that it would not pose an unreasonable risk to public safety is one of the factors. And a period of time has elapsed. In the Act, it's 5 years. The Act relieves all collateral sanctions except in a few circumstances. This certificate is also designed to provide employers, landlords, and others with objective information about the individual under consideration. Now, let me go to the Act. You have it in front of you. Section 2 deals with definitions. Section 3 is a limited scope of the Act. Section 4 is a required duty of the reviser to create a list of the collateral consequences of sanctions. Section 5, an individual must be given formal notice when charged that collateral sanctions may apply. The content of the notice is set out in general terms in the statute, and it's fairly general, but it's to inform the individual that these opportunities or the lack of opportunities may exist. This is under the Act is the responsibility of the prosecuting authority to make sure it's been done.
So Mr. Tennyson?
Yes.
That would be at the point of charging?
Yes. The Section 6, the notice of the collateral consequence, was all given at the time of the conviction or plea. This is the responsibility of the court during the sentencing. And the notice is similar to what's laid out in the statute. Section 7, a collateral sanction may be imposed only by statute or ordinance or by rule of law adopted pursuant to Chapter 14. There was some concern that agencies would, local units would run off and create their own without any centralized way of knowing them. Section 8 sets forth the factors the decision maker must consider in deciding whether to impose disqualification. Now, the decision maker is the person that's doing the hiring or granting a license. If the remedy has been provided to, they can then consider these factors and whether or not even though the person has received a certificate of restoration of rights or limited relief, it's still up to the decision maker to decide whether or not to grant the license or provide the housing, whatever, based on a balancing test. Section 9, this section specifies how to equate offenses committed in another state or federal level with Minnesota law, and it works out a mechanism for doing that. Section 10 allows...
Mr. Tennyson?
Yes, sir.
What do you mean addresses the effect of those convictions? Would it be included in some notice?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Would it be included in some notice to defendants, or would it just be a description somewhere of the impact generally?
If I understand the question right, what the effect of the notice?
Yeah, well, can you explain Section 9 a little bit more, I guess?
Okay. Section 9 states, for example, if the things that are misdemeanor are in one state, it cannot be a higher misdemeanor in this state. It can't be higher than a misdemeanor in this state, even if the facts are such that you might call it a felony in Minnesota or gross misdemeanor. It goes through a series of steps with all the different iterations that would equate how you come out. Basically, it's to make sure that the person who is in Minnesota, if they had something, did something in another state, and we have collateral consequences that relate to that, they have to have equivalency in terms of what the penalty is, or if they're not equivalent, you can't make them.
Treating them as if they had been convicted in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's what you're trying to attempt.
Mr. Chairman, the basic thrust of this section is to not go by labels, but by seek equivalency from some other state to this state.
Thank you.
Going by labels would be a real problem, so you have to go underneath them.
Sure.
And just to illustrate in previous testimony talked about expungement, and you know what it means here in Illinois. If you expunge a record, they literally destroy it. So you're dealing with different concepts, and even though the terminology may be somewhat confusing, same. Section 10 allows a person convicted of an offense to petition for an order of limited relief from one or more collateral sanctions. They have to be specific about it, and it says what the collateral sanctions are they can seek relief from. Employment, relating to employment, education, housing, public benefits, and occupational licensing. And that order can be, that petition can be made in the court when the person is being sentenced. They could ask the court to make that decision. Or if they're in the Department of Corrections custody, they can ask they can file that petition with the Department of Corrections. And they can do that anytime. And you can do that anytime, even if you're out of prison. Section 11 allows a person to apply for restoration a certificate of restoration of rights, relieving collateral sanctions, and there's a 5-year waiting period for that to happen. So it would have to be 5 years after the last after they completed their paper. Section 12 lists the statutes that would not be subject to collateral this act, this order for limited relief or restoration of rights, and basically the sex offender acts and the crimes and the DUIs. Section 13 requires the Department of Corrections to notify the people when a petition is filed and so on. The court would have to do that too. And then it provides some, Section 14 provides some protection to an employer or whoever hires a person who has received an order of limited relief or certificate of restoration of rights. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Judge Davis, did you want to add anything before we...
I would, Chairman, members of the committee, I just suggested it's this was a very cautiously drafted act, recognizing the problem, and I think in its most valuable thrust, this sets up the possibility of some evolution in this area. Section 10 happens to be my favorite section in the Act, the one of the order for limited relief. And I think that's a wonderful provision, setting a stage for the judiciary becoming wiser in how it deals with criminal defendants.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Commissioner Davies has one advantage. He served on the committee that drafted this act, and I didn't, so he's more familiar with all the history that went into it and who testified and what the issues were. So I appreciate his comments.
So I can, Chairman, I can vouch for the care that was extended to the drafting.
And this was a three-year project for the Uniform Law Conference. It wasn't popped out overnight. It was a serious consideration. So I appreciate the time, and I thank you.
Mr. Tennyson, I think Senator Goodwin had a question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Maybe this is more for counsel. What I'm wanting to know about more is in Section 12, the statute that is cited there in number 1, 243-166 and 243-167. First of all, what is that statute? And then I have some follow-up questions, because those are the ones that we're looking at here under Section 12 is the crimes that are not subject to relief through collateral sanctions. So I wanted to know what we're naming there.
Senate counsel has something to add on this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, at least for line 8.32, those two sections are the two sections relating to registration as a predatory offender.
Okay.
So those would be those type of crimes. Clause 2, I'd have to look some of them up, but they're basically DWI and other types of traffic-type offenses. And if you need to, I can work with you specifically as to each one, but the 169A references are DWIs.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. And then
Senator
also,
Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 9.3, those statutory citations, 387.36 and 419.06.
Mr. Chair and Reps, Senator Goodwin, I'd have to look those two up.
Okay. And then my other question maybe for Mr. Tennyson is when you name these departments, the Department of Human Services is not there. Is there a reason for that? Because I know that's the department that determines whether or not somebody is eligible with their with a criminal record for employment in nursing homes and hospitals and those kinds of things.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, the Uniform Act suggests a state agency, appropriate state agency, and I think in drafting this, Michelle Timmons, who is the advisor, was also on a drafting committee. She selected that agency as the one, the Corrections Department. I met with the Department of Human Services, and I know they do a lot of the work, but it seemed, I think the justification for that is more related to criminal activity. They're in the prison, they know, the Department of Corrections would know how the person had been performing in prison. They have a record of how they, a better chance of making a judgment as to whether that person should get the relief or not.
Follow up, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't think I'm quite understanding totally yet. Does this mean then that the Department of Human Services would not be able to determine ineligibility for employment?
I think what it does,
Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, the department may be the decision maker, deciding to grant a license or not. This would give them the discretion that's lacking now. So basically, the mandatory disqualifications or mandatory penalties would become discretionary, except in those cases that are excluded. So the department could look at that and make a judgment based upon this statute and others to what they do call a set-aside, but set aside the sanction.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I have a couple more questions. I think this is a very interesting and innovative approach to very innovative and good approach. I'm wondering if and I tried to read through this quickly and listen to your explanation of it, but I have a couple more questions for you. Then what we're doing and then is repealing all the other current collateral sanctions and replacing it with Section 12, basically. Is that, am I correct?
No. We're not repealing it. Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, we're not repealing the collateral sanctions. What we're doing, the repealers, if you look at Chapter 609B, listed here somewhere, there's a ton of those. Those are the repealers of the deferral. So all 609B, and they'll be replaced with an electronic list of collateral sanctions so that it's more easily referenced and more complete.
And thank you, Mr. Tennyson. And one more final question. Is there anything in here that then requires either an employer or a landlord or somebody to accept this certificate of relief? Whatever we're calling it.
Mr. Chairman,
Tennyson.
Senator Goodwin, no, I don't think it requires anybody to do anything except in that regard. The person would still have to make a judgment, but it takes the automatic bar by law and makes it discretionary. So it gives the person some ability to provide the educational benefit or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, the main thing it does for employers, Senator Goodwin, is to protect them from liability for hiring somebody who they know has a record, but they want to hire them, they think they should have a job, and so on. If they guess wrong, which will happen. That will happen. If they guess wrong, they will not pay a price for it in civil liability.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, it allows for a rational connection between what they did and the consequences, collateral consequences. As Bob Johnson said, or he wrote, right now, the judge can make a judgment in sentencing somebody based on all the circumstances. They have no discretion in this area, which just doesn't lead to rational results in many cases.
Thank you.
Senator Sherman.
The issue related to the Department of Human Services, it would be helpful to me. I need to be clearer about a couple of things. First of all, if I understand correctly what's being said, one of the things that's being changed is the ability of a decision-making process that's now completely determined by what's in statute and gives some authority back to the Department of Human Services to have some discretionary decision making. That's a change. And the history for which that authority was taken away, which was in place at one time, was a reaction by the legislature to the risks that were placed upon the public to be exposed to persons who might have a risk to offend them if they're vulnerable adults or if they're children, etc. Is that correct?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I am from the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services, and it's in that office where we do background studies, and we do a lot of them, about 278,000 a year. So the if I can just kind of explain how this bill, Senator Sharon, would interact with our system. Under our current process, when we do these background studies and we discover that somebody has a criminal record that is one of those listed in the statute, the individual is disqualified. In most cases, the individual has an opportunity for an individualized review where that person can demonstrate how, notwithstanding the fact that I have that criminal record, today I don't pose a risk of harm, and this is why. And the variables that are to be considered by the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health, or in some cases by the Department of Corrections, are set out in our background study law. And so that individual gets to sort of demonstrate how they don't pose that risk of harm in that setting, dealing with those either vulnerable adults or children. However, there are some crimes, some offenses that would cause somebody to be disqualified for which they don't have the opportunity for that individualized review. They don't get a chance to request reconsideration or a possible set aside of that disqualification. And those are, you know, understandably the most egregious crimes. Those are the crimes that situation is what sort of gets addressed by this bill. It's really, in those cases, it's by operation of law that the individual is disqualified, period. They're out. And there is not any mechanism for them to ever get an individualized review. Under this bill, if an individual then goes through this process and gets that certificate of restoration of rights, that certificate would enable that person this review process. It doesn't guarantee the outcome, and it just is all it does, and we've worked on some possible amendments for the bill as it goes through. What it would do is it would give that individual that chance to get that individualized review using those same determination standards, you know, the variables that we look at to determine risk. And then at the end of the day, all of the appeal process would kick in for that individual too. It just sort of brings them back into that opportunity for an individual review. And that's sort of the difference between a consequence and a sanction. And so it's those sanctions that by operation of law are automatically applied to people under these many provisions that they've outlined. Is that helpful?
So Mr. Kerber, would it do that for all currently disqualifying offenses? If you get a certificate of restoration of rights, and even the most egregious convictions that currently you don't even get a chance to be have set aside would be theoretically could be set aside?
Two exceptions.
Senator Latz, generally most people have that opportunity now. And so what really gets targeted here are just those people who don't have that opportunity now would get that opportunity for that individualized review.
Because of the more limited number of
yes.
of disqualifying convictions. And those would, so, right. But all of those, if someone were convicted of rape or murder that are now in absolute bars
right.
to licensing, if they got a restoration of rights, well, maybe they mm-hmm. wouldn't, but if they got that certificate restoring their rights, they could theoretically apply to have that set aside, and you may or may not decide.
The Chairman, not quite.
Judge
because
Davis.
Rape is one of those that's left out. The sex crimes was felt to be, sex offenders were felt to be too deep water for this particular bill, and you're going to deal with that in some other legislation this session. I think the governor has announced. And the reason the traffic offenses are left out is that there is a In the Department of Motor Vehicles, a procedure by which you can get your driver's privilege adjusted so that there's no need for it to be covered in this act. So those are the two main exclusions.
So it'd be fair to say it broadens the availability of discretionary relief, but doesn't broaden it to every offense. You're still excluding sex offenses. You're still excluding driving while impaired offenses and no insurance violations, some of those traffic matters that have separate mechanisms for judicial or administrative review.
I think we knew, Mr. Chairman, how complicated the issue was, and we wanted to punt on that one.
Senator Letts.
Senator Sherman.
I appreciate this conversation. I know I've been in conversations before, certainly with constituents that would have liked to have seen the department, liked to have had an opportunity to get in front of somebody that could see the, some of the subtleties of what were going on, and instead of having something so prescriptive in law that allows some reasonableness to that decision-making process. I support that at a 30,000-foot level. But I'm also very concerned about, as we've talked more and more about licensed individuals who have the ability to work with very vulnerable populations, and we'll be talking about this more as it relates to the disciplinary processes for persons with licenses because of who they are working with. That we're not in our sincere desire to have a person have an opportunity for reform, that we ask the public to take too much risk in that matter. There is a balance here between the risk that the public has to take because of what we're trying to accomplish in reform. And I will be paying very close attention that doesn't ask the public risk to be too high.
Mr. Chairman,
Judge Davis.
The reason Section 10 in the bill is my favorite section is relevant to this. That, in my view, there are a lot of crimes that are theft, they're property crimes of that sort. And then there are other crimes that are crimes of violence, of anger management problems, and so on. And I think under Section 10, we're going to evolve into a recognition of that distinction and other distinctions. If it's just somebody steals and you think they're over that problem, you can let them back into a situation where there's no where you don't have to fear violence. And that's why those limited order for relief has just great potential.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Sherman, let me draw your attention to page, or it's section 10, line 7.26. It provides for the balancing test involving public safety and the safety of the individual.
Senator Letts, I would just say that it just takes one time. That's what happened, I suspect, in the past, because in the past, if I am correct, Mr. Kerber, you had that authority to have more discriminatory evaluation of these circumstances for allowing people to be employed in certain professions within the Department of Human Services. And that was taken away, and it usually comes out of some process where bad things happen, and you've made a decision, and then you have to, it gets taken away from you. So I like the idea of having, good evaluation of the subtleties of what's happening so that decisions are made, that you don't have just a brush that just covers everybody just to save a few problematic situations. But I'm just saying, on the other hand, I will try to understand explicitly that we are not moving too far over in the guise of being helpful to ask the public to take too much risk. And in that, if the decision making is taken out of statute and put back in your hands, what are you going to be placing in your system that assures that that evaluation process is done by people who are who know what they're doing.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Sharon, the when this change to the law happened in 2005, when the discretion to make these types of decisions was removed, it was really during a legislative session, you know, following Katie Poyer murder and Drew Shaheen, and there were many, many concerns about sex offender issues, and it coincided with a local newspaper series about our ability to grant set-asides of disqualifications that could conceptually allow sex offenders to work in child care. There were no sort of smoking gun cases, but it was, you know, it was a concern that there was a very high level of discretion awarded to the administration, to the Department of Human Services and Department of Health, and that there would be some comfort in those days if that discretion were limited. This bill, as I stand corrected on the breadth of it, does exclude those sex crime offense. You know, those offenses are not part of this discretion that would be, you know, very carefully reinstated in some of these cases. It's excluding those sex crimes, and so it's really limited to that. Well, you know, not that there's any great comfort in that either, but there's kidnapping and murders and homicides and, you know, of various types. The DUI issue is not, DUIs in our world are not a disqualifying characteristic unless they're a felony level, but they're not a permanent disqualification. So there's already the discretion in place. And so somebody wouldn't be pursuing this avenue to get that discretion in place because it's already there. But your concerns are certainly very valid here, and I think that's exactly the discussion that needs to take place and has, I think, every legislative session since 2005 about whether or not there is sufficient comfort in restoring some of that discretion. Do the state agencies have enough controls over the situation? Are they taking it seriously enough so that when we determine that there's we're convinced that there's a minimal risk of harm, the risk that would be realized would be the risk with other people's children or vulnerable adults or disabled family members. You know, we are not the ones that would suffer that consequence. And so, I mean, it's such a good question about, you know, do we take it seriously enough? And I think we would continue having those conversations. We make a lot of these decisions now, and, you know, by and large, these are not the individuals that are committing new acts of maltreatment out there. Some go ahead and do, and that's unfortunate. But by and large, the people who we are granting these set-asides to now are people who then perform well in their job environments.
So I think for us to get comfortable, for the committee to get comfortable with these provisions, we'd have to have a pretty clearly identified scope for us to evaluate what's included, what's not included, what's moving from the non-discretionary category into a discretionary category, what remains in a non-discretionary category, so that we can decide, is the line being drawn at the right place for the members of the committee to be comfortable? And, of course, the policy committees that have oversight over some of those particular areas, like Senator Sharon's policy committee, would need to get comfortable also with where the lines are being drawn. And that's something that you guys can help us with, and
right.
The Senate Council here.
That's true.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, we'll also be working with state public defenders and probation people to provide examples of how this is working now and how it's not working and what the impediments are for a lot of people, which seem to make no rational sense. No impediments to employment and housing and that, which is not related to the crime, but because they committed some crime is an automatic bar.
So you're also working with the county attorney community as well on some of this?
Yeah, I met with John Kingery, and this afternoon I'm going over to the Bar Association to talk to the Bar's criminal law section, which includes prosecutors and defense.
Sure. Senator Sharon, did you have any follow-up on that?
Well, I wasn't sure it was clear in what you were saying, but another follow-up that you stimulated my mind. Senator Limmer, before he was here, was talking about staying within original proposal or scope of the proposal and to not move outside of that too far. And they mentioned housing. Is this affecting housing in some way?
Well,
because that's also in my committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of the automatic bars may affect housing.
Is it eligibility for public housing, or is it landlord-tenant issues, that you're, the landlord's right to protect multifamily housing because of a person's prior felony history that would be of concern to them? Where everybody moves out because the people are afraid of who's moving in.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, most of our conversation was about public housing. Relationships between private landlords and tenants, I don't think is seriously affected. But it's been a long time since our committee ended its work, and I'm not sure of my memory there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, again, in Section 10,
Mr. Tennyson,
line 7.22, that subparagraph there lists the types of benefits or opportunities that would be made available: education, employment, housing, public benefits, occupational licensing. So that's specifically included.
And Senator Latz, if
Senator
I may,
Sharon.
I'd like to understand what that means more, because if I don't know if the current law prohibits somebody because they have a felony from being eligible for housing grants or scholarships or entrance into a university or something, which would prohibit their potential ability to reform and to stay reformed. So that is one set of supports that I understand would be helpful. But there's another side that if you are extracting information that somebody needs to have to make a decision about their investment in housing, and they can't have access to that, but the public gets access to it. And, I'm just talking about a multifamily housing project where you have a person who has a certain history that of, I don't know what, violence or something, and if it's a family unit and people discover that and they leave the unit. But so we've got somebody housed there that has certainly every right to try to reform, but the property owner has lost a significant number of people who are renting in that facility. I want to know if this creates that scenario, potential scenario for a property owner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I don't think that's a collateral consequence. In public housing areas, there are, I think there's some federal laws probably as well as some state laws, that if you're convicted of certain things, you can't qualify for public housing. I don't think that applies to the private sector.
Senator Goodman. I'm sorry.
Senator Sharon. I'd like to learn more about what that means. Even in public housing, you can have access to subsidy to housing, but the housing may not be publicly owned. But you're still on a public program. So.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you mean Section 8 type of financing.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we'll get that information. And try to bring it more concrete or make it more concrete so that you have hard examples of what we're talking about. And we happen to meet with you individually and answer any other questions you have. And if anybody wants to contact me, do so. And we'll get answers.
Thank you.
Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who can answer this question, but once again, I'm going to go back to Section 12 because I know, and I believe, maybe I'm wrong, that currently you can't get an occupational license if you have DWIs or a series of DWIs, or you can have an occupational license, for example, teaching or other things taken away if you have certain traffic offenses, even DWIs in particular. I heard somewhere that 1 in 5 Minnesotans will have a DWI at some time or have had a DWI at some time. I don't know if that's correct, but that's what I heard, and that's quite a few. So my concern is these, like DWIs, people that were 18 when they committed that crime, or they were an underage drinker at 18 or 19, and they have been going to school for a certain occupation and then suddenly become ineligible for a license. If we exclude the Department of these offenses here from make them ineligible because they already have some kind of a relief under MnDOT or wherever, that won't change the fact that some people are still not allowed to get occupational licenses. So I don't know if there's something in here that will fix that or or what. But
Mr. Can Chair,
you answer that?
Senator, you're asking us to expand the bill a little bit, I guess. and there may be good reasons to do that. I'm not sure if the committee wanted to entertain that, you know, I wouldn't mind. Considering it and trying to work it out, but to try and do that at this point is difficult. But I think I think those collateral sanctions ought to be addressed. I'll give you an example. It's not covered here, but I was talking to one of the people on the field today who works with this population, and she gave me a couple of examples of what she thought were improper or unreasonable consequences. Some young man's at a party. A lot of people there, and he goes out in the yard and relieves himself, and is charged with exposure. Now he's got to register as a sex offender. Are your kids, college kids, and are getting somebody's in a party and getting a fight? Now they're charged with assault. Disqualifying a lot of things, and no discretion and stuff. She gave me another example of a woman who was an immigrant farm worker whose parents abandoned her, and her family took her in, and she was going to school, and the family had a son who was going to school too. They were 2 years apart, or a year apart in high school. This is a long story, but apparently the family encouraged a relationship. And she had a baby, and when the boy put his name on the birth certificate, he was 3 years younger than she was. So she is charged with raping a child, and was given a stay of imposition. But in the meantime, she had been working at a nursing home as a nurse's aide. Of course, she's fired. Now she can't work. No discretion.
So,
you get all kinds of variation because the human people. A lot of variation. So, you know, it sounds good to say we're going to ban all sex offenders from whatever, but, you know, how do you define a sex offender and what are the circumstances and all that? So I think there's an area for you to study. It's not in this bill, but.
Senator, thank you. I understand that. I'm just thinking what a big issue this is for people, particularly those that are trying to get back on their feet, maybe after a tough time, so they go to college, they get their degree in something, and then they find out they can't be licensed in that field, and that they did not know that when they finished their education. Or like the students I dealt with last year at the University of Minnesota when we passed the bill, the Good Samaritan bill, that if underage drinkers are at a party, they the ones that, and somebody passes out or gets sick, the ones that call for help or whatever, they are not going to be get ticketed for underage drinking. But others there might be, or would be if the police came. And then suddenly they're ineligible for licensing of certain types of occupational licenses, even if they're in their second, third, or fourth year of college and just about ready to graduate, when we all know that most of us did that kind of drinking or tried it when we were 18 to 21, and there, but for the grace of God, we didn't get ticketed for underage drinking. So I'm just concerned that I think those sanctions are pretty tough currently, and maybe it's not something we can address in this bill. Well, but we're particularly eliminating any redress on that by having those offenses listed in the ineligible section.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, you mentioned the driving, and on the way over here, it was reported on public radio that 1 in 8 Minnesota drivers is not properly licensed. They're driving without a license, and that's some of that's the consequences of not being able to have a license because of something, and they're going to go to work. They either go to work and get a job and pay for support their family, or violate the law, or not violate the law. So they're going to violate the law and support their family. I mean, that's a practical consequence of some of these kind of restrictions.
Mr. Chairman, I think I may have overstated the exclusion of driving offenses. It's this act provides no remedy for getting a new license, because we have in our law now a provision for that. Now, external other consequences beyond that, I think this act may come. And it may be very, very helpful for your precise problem.
Thank you.
So, Judge Davies, so for example, in Section 12, on lines 8.3334 and on the page 9, it addresses the license withdrawal provision, saying we've already got provisions in the law on implied consent petitions or 17119 petitions to have judicial review of license revocations or suspensions or cancellations. And those provisions would apply in those cases. Your bill would not provide any alternative way to get your license back.
Precisely.
And line 8.32, where it makes reference to requirements under sections 243.166 and 167, those are sex offender registration provisions. So, this bill would not affect whether or not someone has to register as a sex offender, but it might provide some relief from other collateral sanctions flowing from the conviction for a sex offense through the mechanisms that are set up in the bill for the issuance of certain certificates, depending on the nature of the offense. Am I stating that correctly?
I think that's right.
Okay. I don't sense that there are many concerns or questions about the notice provisions in here. It sounds like, as a general matter, members of the committee, or at least those who are here right now, are comfortable making sure everyone receives adequate notice before they make decisions about, you know, pleading guilty or going through the criminal justice process as to what the collateral sanctions would be if they get convicted of this offense or that offense, and they can make fully informed decisions in that regard. Where we may run into some issues is just sort of the administrative matters of putting those notices together, particular to any offense. I mean, when you're in a courtroom and you've got three charges and you got a person sitting, you know, at the counsel table as they're going through the arraignment calendar, and, you know, some defendant is trying to decide, well, do I plead to obstruction of legal process, or do I plead to assault, or do I plead to disorderly conduct? And then the prosecutor has a duty under this provision to let that defendant know what are the collateral consequences for each of those convictions if you were to plead guilty to that. It could certainly slow the process down, in addition to adding paperwork requirements, if nothing else, for the prosecutors or for the courts to make sure that information is available at the time that decision is made. So we'll have to think about how we can streamline that process. If I'm reading this correctly, or maybe just at the time of charging, they have to send out some generalized document that says, if you've been charged with this, these are the consequences. If you've been charged with that, these are the consequences. And maybe that'll be considered sufficient.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Tennyson,
in response to your question, let me say that I've talked with the County Attorney's Association. They're concerned about them having a responsibility in giving a notice. But if you go to Section 5 of the bill on page 4, and starting in line 4.17, you know, the notice is pretty general. It tells them that there are collateral consequences. It's not required that the county attorney tell them what specific ones apply to them. It's just that they're there. Here's where you find them. You better know that they're there, so don't be surprised if something happens to you that you plead guilty, other than what's there. So it's not. You don't have to sit down and tell Jack Davies that these are the specific consequences of what.
No particularized notice to be required. Just more of a general. You may face additional consequences. If you're concerned about that, you should go look it up.
Well, and that's to let them know that there are, and there also may be ways to avoid those collateral consequences. So if you look at the criteria there, the notice, that's basically the summary of the notice, and that could be put on a form. It couldn't be put in a plea agreement, you know, whatever.
Well, one might argue that it'd be the duty of some counsel in the courtroom to do that now, although my understanding is you cannot attack a plea or a conviction collaterally for having not been informed of this prior to deciding to enter a plea of guilty. Okay, are there any other thoughts or questions about the bill? This is a pretty meaty bill. It could have very substantial implications, benefits to persons trying to get back on their feet. But we need to make sure we do it the right way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm not seeing any further questions or comments from members of the committee. I want to thank the committee for your time in going through all of these, and Mr. Tennyson, Mr. Davies, and the others who testified here today.
I suspect one of the collateral consequences of me being here is I have a parking ticket.
I don't think your bill provides relief for that, Mr. Tennyson. Just so all of you know, we do not have any other pre-session committees scheduled for the Judiciary Committee at this time. The next planned committee hearing will be an official committee meeting on the Thursday after session begins, so February 27th at noon here in Capitol Room 15. So thank you. Have a good run-up. Get all your extracurricular activities done before session starts, because I got a feeling we're going to be
riding
the fast horse once we get here. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, in looking down the road a little bit for the session, do you anticipate a real busy schedule for the Judiciary Committee to the point that it may push into evening hours?
Senator Limmer, you know how we hate to have evening hearings here at the Capitol. We just got our deadlines were released today, and March 21st is the first deadline.
It's fast.
March 28th is the second deadline, 1 week later. Then 1 week after that is the third deadline. Right now we don't have any evenings scheduled. We have set aside room time on Fridays in the event that we need extra time for the committee. So it's my hope that Tuesday and Thursday times will be only daytime hearings, and that we can restrict Friday hearings also to daytime. I guess we'll see how things go. Last session, I think we had kind of a build-up from previous years of some initiatives, and we had some particularly time-consuming issues that took this committee's attention. I would hope not to duplicate that level of intensity, but we've got short deadlines, and so I guess we could take comfort in knowing if it's intense, it will be short.
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, the Judiciary Committee has always had a fine tradition of being very thorough and being kind of like the last stop before something is worthy enough to go to the Senate floor. So I certainly wish to expedite as much legislation and new law on the people of Minnesota as much as possible as you do. So.
Thank you. We do need to make sure that that when something gets to the floor out of this committee, that it is reasonably relied upon, that we took a thorough look at it, and it's ready to be enacted. So any other comments from the members of the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
Human Services is meeting every day.